On 19 May 1943, the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress, nicknamed Memphis Belle, flew her last missions over Nazi-occupied France and Germany. One of the first U.S. heavy bombers to complete 25 combat missions, Belle returned to the States that month for a war bond tour. Today, this venerable war bird is being restored for display at the National Museum of the U.S. Air Force in Dayton, Ohio. I'm Oliver North, and this podcast is all about bombers, B-17s like Memphis Belle, and B-24 Liberators, and the extraordinary young Americans who flew them through skies full of flak and enemy fighters. During World War II, the U.S. produced 12,731 B-17s and 18,482 B-24 flying boxcars. These workhorse heavy bombers dropped more than a million tons of bombs over Nazi targets in Europe from 1942 to 1945. Missions to the oil fields of Romania and the rail yards and Messerschmitt plants of Germany targeted the Nazi war machine and its ability to make war. These missions were conducted at a terrible price. Nearly a quarter of all the heavy bombers the U.S. built went down in accidents, from anti-aircraft fire, or in air-to-air engagements with enemy fighters. If a bomber went down behind enemy territory, the crewmen aboard usually faced two options, death or capture. Nearly half those who took off from bases in England, North Africa, or Italy didn't make it back. In this podcast, you'll hear from a 21-year-old pilot named George McGovern, who crashed his plane three times and lived to become part of our nation's political history. Listen carefully to the voices in this podcast describe what it was like in the skies over war-torn Europe. These are the pilots, navigators, gunners, and bombardiers of the Army Air Corps who stared death in the face on every mission they flew.
Good evening, I'm Oliver North, and this is War Stories. Behind me is a consolidated B-24 Liberator. Along with its counterpart, the Boeing B-17 Flying Fortress, bombers like this dropped over a million tons of bombs over Nazi targets in Europe from 1942 to 1945. These missions weren't without a price, and almost half of those who took off from bases in England, North Africa, and Italy didn't make it back. A 21-year-old pilot named George McGovern was hit by enemy fire and crashed his plane three times. Tonight on War Stories, we bring you the story of the other front line, the skies over Europe, where the pilots, navigators, gunners, and bombardiers of the Army Air Corps stared death in the face on every mission they flew.
London bombed, a suburban area where explosive was rained from the sky.
1939. Movie reels brought the war in Europe home to America. Though angered and nervous about Hitler's blitzkrieg through Europe and the savage air attacks on Britain, Washington was still publicly neutral.
I am a pacifist. You are pacifists, too.
But behind the scenes, the U.S. was quietly gearing up for the inevitable entry into the war. World War II expert and author of Wings of Morning, Professor Thomas Childers, explains.
The United States, on the eve of the Second World War, when war broke out in Europe in 1939, was almost a disarmed country. The Roosevelt administration could see the handwriting on the wall, found themselves in a very difficult position indeed, and had an uphill battle. All of the preliminary work had to be done in an environment of isolationism.
FDR wasn't the only one to see what was on the horizon. Young men and boys by the thousands decided to sign up for military service before being drafted. This meant they could choose the branch of service they wanted to be in. 22-year-old Robert Morgan from Asheville, North Carolina, knew what he wanted.
Oh, well, then why not try up in there?
I think what's really interesting about this is that these guys, for the vast, vast majority of them, had never been in an airplane before. These men suddenly, a lot of them, had driver's license.
The vast mechanized armies of the Nazis blast their way toward Paris.
June 14th, 1940. While the Nazis stormed into Paris, would-be pilots were all signed up with no place to go. Training hadn't started yet. Young George McGovern was put on the waiting list.
They didn't have any pilots to train us. didn't have any airplanes, didn't have any airfields. So it was almost another year. It was the following February before we were sworn in.
It was a very daunting task that was confronting those people in the military and in the Roosevelt administration.
Even though I applied in November of 1940, they didn't call me up until March of 1941.
The Army found it necessary to turn to private contractors.
Civilian pilot training schools were first established around the country in the late 1930s. The military used these civvy pilots to give the boys their first lessons on single-engine aircraft. Robert Sternfels, former dental product salesman from Detroit, would get the ride of his life.
Well, the first flight was a disaster because they gave us sheepskin helmets and they didn't have any ventilation. And the sheepskin odor finally got to me. And I left my mark inside of that cockpit that day.
The first time he took me up, he did spin, slow roll, snap roll. When he finished that hour of training, I was wondering whether I was meant for the Army Air Corps.
While the Army Air Corps scrambled to build air bases and train pilots, military planners were developing new strategies. To strike at the heart of the German industrial center, to cripple the Third Reich's ability to make war, they knew what they had to do. They had to build planes and build them fast. But how to do it?
The air planners looked around. Of course, there was no mass fleet of bombers. So they turned to private industry in the United States. And turned to the Boeing Corporation out in Seattle.
The sleek Boeing B-17 was a state-of-the-art four-engine bomber. It weighed 27 tons and could fly at an altitude of more than 20,000 feet. It carried a bomb load of 6,000 pounds and was equipped with 13 50-caliber machine guns. Then Buck Sergeant Frank Freeman remembers how the B-17 got its name.
When the plane was first built, I think it was out in Seattle, Washington, they were flying it. And one of the writers described it as a flying fortress with all the machine guns on board.
The term stuck. The idea was you've got guns in the waist, turret below, a tail gunner, a top turret gunner, that the plane would be able to defend itself against enemy aircraft.
It was the only plane in the world that would take a beating and still stay in the air like they were.
Washington also contracted the Consolidated Corporation to produce a new bomber. They designated the B-24.
What was their sense for what that airplane was like?
It was the biggest bomber we had at that time, but it would fly further, faster, carry a bigger bomb load than any other plane.
But those that flew in the B-24, like Frank Tedesco from Weymouth, Mass., and George McGovern, knew it wasn't like flying the more comfortable B-17.
The interior of the plane was cramped, crowded, cold, and dangerous.
It was a very difficult airplane to fly. I mean, physically different. You had to use every muscle in your body to keep that plane on a mission for 8 hours, 10 hours, 12 hours.
The plane was designed and built for one purpose only, and obviously that was for dropping bombs.
The B-24 was nicknamed the Flying Boxcar. It wouldn't win any beauty contest, but it was just what the Air Corps needed. Now they had to mass produce these planes in a very short period of time. The Army went to the man who wanted to put a car in every American's driveway.
The government turns to Henry Ford and says, can you make these parts for what would be the B-24 bomber? And Ford said, no, I can't. I'll make the whole airplane. And then would construct an enormous facility west of Detroit, Willow Run.
While Ford ramped up production, Tedesco and 20-year-old Dave Hutchins began their training on the B-24 and the B-17. The bombers were state-of-the-art machinery, and their size was intimidating.
I felt like I was flying an apartment house around.
It was sort of like asking somebody to fly the space shuttle.
I stood beside one, and I honestly felt like I was standing beside a hangar.
The pilots were shuttled from state to state, airbase to airbase, learning all they could about flying the giant bombers.
Tucson is where we trained in B-24s. That's our initial training. And then we flew to Alamogordo, New Mexico, for advanced B-24 training.
The men who were going to be flying these big four-engine planes took 9 months to a year to train.
This training brought its own set of tragedies.
It was a very common occurrence to see a pilot take off, suddenly lose altitude at the end of the runway, and explode in a great billowing orange-streaked cloud of flame.
By the time Germany declared war on the United States on December 11, 1941, the first wave of recruits were in their final stages of training. The crews consisted of two pilots, a navigator, radio man, bombardier, and five gunners.
It was a very interesting crew because it was spread guys from all over the United States. It was strange how we fitted together so well. I mean, it was just a real perfect match.
Everybody had their function.
You can't be a master of every job. They recognized that I had a job to do, and they let me do my job, and I let them do their job. And we got along real well.
Trained and ready to fly, the crews were on their way to combat. Some were assigned to the newly formed 8th Air Force based in England.
And the British were building these bases just as fast as they could.
This area of England was transformed into a gigantic air base. It was, somebody called it, the biggest aircraft carrier in the world.
The first missions to the coast of France were so smooth, it would give some a false sense of security.
I will always remember that night, sitting around the bar. Everybody said, gee whiz, you know, this is not going to be bad. We'll get this over with a pretty big hurry.
A top-secret mission into the heart of the Third Reich's industrial heartland when War Stories returns.
Target is a German naval supply center in France.
Nobody had any idea in 1942 when these men arrived in England what sort of casualty rates they would be facing.
In August of 1942, the 8th Air Force launched its first real missions over mainland Europe. The B-17s and 24s had fighter escort only as far as the English Channel. After that, they were on their own. As they flew past the coast of France, they were met by elite squadrons of the notorious German Luftwaffe. 20-year-old co-pilot Richard Butler remembers his first run-in with the German Air Force.
We were intercepted by yellow-nosed Focke-Wulfs, and they had quite a reputation as being very aggressive.
We had been warned that the fighters were going to give us trouble.
The casualties began to mount, both from fighter interference and from anti-aircraft fire. Of the casualties, 37% were lost in the first three missions.
As the 8th Air Force fought off the Luftwaffe, General George Patton was driving the Desert Fox, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel, out of North Africa. The newly acquired ocean of sand, known as the Sahara Desert, supplied what the Allies desperately needed, land for air bases. Sternfels and Butler were among the first assigned to the arid wasteland.
They then told us where we were going to go, and that was out in the desert into Benghazi, Libya. And that's a hellhole, really.
It was pretty rough.
The first thing we did in Benghazi, they gave us two shovels. We dug into the desert and then put a tent over this hole that we had dug. The temperatures went up to about 120 degrees during the day.
The boys began training for a top-secret low-altitude bombing run.
The training was low-level, and I mean, it was down on the ground.
Pilots, the crew, were not happy about this. 500 feet, I mean, somebody with a 50-caliber machine gun could knock you out of the air for what being hit by a slingshot.
A couple of airplanes actually scraped the desert. We heard that one airplane had hit a camel and killed it.
This would be no ordinary mission.
I'd say about 2 days before the mission, we start getting briefings on where we were going and what was expected.
At the briefing, the boys learned the details of what was to be known as Operation Tidal Wave. A formation of 175 B-24s were to take off from the Libyan desert and head north across the Aegean Sea. After clearing the Balkans, they were to descend to an altitude of 500 feet or lower to avoid German radar. The formation would then drop its bombs on the oil fields and refineries of Ploiești, Romania. Ploiești, Romania was Hitler's black gold mine. It was the key to fueling the Third Reich's war machine.
Ploiești in Romania produced about 40% of Germany's overall crude oil.
The general said if the mission was successful and the refineries were destroyed and every one of our airplanes was lost, it would still be worthwhile.
There was two things that they said for us to do. Number one, write a letter home and we mail it if you don't come back. Number two, pack your bags and put it on top of your cots. So we knew damn well that they didn't have all the answers.
The commander of the Ninth Air Force, Louis Brereton, was actually presented with two options. One was a high altitude raid, and the other was the low. He chose the low. The crews petitioned and said, maybe we should rethink this. And Brereton said, any commander who doesn't want to be part of this is gone.
The boys, including Sternfels and Butler, were well-trained and experienced, but nothing could prepare them for one of the most dangerous missions ever attempted by the Army Air Corps. Take this plane and bomb the enemy by flying so low they'd barely clear the treetops. That's next on War Stories. August 1st, 1943, up before sunrise, Sternfels and Butler readied themselves for the bloodiest mission they'd ever fly.
We went to a rather short briefing. I can remember our group commander saying, now, if anybody doesn't want to go, don't go. Nobody declined.
And we took off. One airplane apparently lost an engine right after takeoff. He started to lose a lot of altitude, and in doing so, he hit a concrete telephone pole, and he went in and splattered the whole airplane all over the desert. There were a couple of survivors, but all the rest of them perished.
We joined up in the overall formation, flying out across the Mediterranean until we saw one of the airplanes up ahead of us in a spin and go down. This is the second airplane we'd seen go in.
Two planes down, and they weren't even past the Mediterranean yet.
As the formation, which had already lost now a number of planes, approached the IP, one of the lead aircraft veered off in the wrong direction.
The IP was the point where the planes were supposed to make their final turn in the direction of their target. But before they reached it, Colonel K.K. Compton, leader of the 376th Bomb Group, ran into a thick layer of clouds.
The 376th and the 93rd climbed to get above the clouds, picked up a tailwind, so consequently got quite a ways ahead of our other three groups.
He turned prior to the time that he was supposed to.
He had to turn off subsequent groups. No, and actually broke radio silence.
And they were hollering to the leader that this is the wrong place, the wrong turn, wrong turn. The colonel that was flying the first airplane, and he said he never heard anybody call him.
Colonel Compton kept to radio silence. He had no idea the other crews were trying to tell him he'd made a wrong turn. Only when he saw the streets of Bucharest, Romania, instead of the refineries of Ploiești, did he realize they'd veered off course.
Our group was behind them about 20 minutes. Didn't make that error. We went on to the proper place, or IP, and then we turned to the right and went into the target.
Now you've got all of these groups of B-24s approaching the target from different directions. By the time they reached Ploiești, they made another terrible discovery.
The Germans knew they were coming.
The Germans and the Romanians knew that a large bomber force was on its way. Flying at low altitude made no difference.
All of a sudden, there was all kinds of opposition. Haystacks swung open, and guns in there started firing at us. Off to the right, we could see a train that was firing at us.
The Germans had quite a few flak batteries around Ploiești of the great 88s, the big anti-aircraft guns.
Anti-aircraft fire pounded the bombers, and flying at low altitude, it opened up a Pandora's box of new problems.
The planes were so low that the gunners on the B-24s were actually engaged in battles with gunners on the ground. This is what four-engine B-24 is supposed to be doing, but they were that low.
Lloyd Nieper, our flight engineer, said that our right wing came within 20 feet of scraping the ground.
The prop wash over that target was so severe. You got 200 propellers that are chewing up the air, and when you go through it, why, it's rough as hell. So things were just happening one thing after another.
If that wasn't enough, the Germans were also sending up barrage balloons, which could wreak havoc with the aircraft's propellers. Both Sternfels and Butler had run-ins with the lethal contraptions.
I hit one of them, and the cable wound around the prop and broke and came into the airplane.
We caught it right between the fuselage and the number three engine. We lost number three engine from that.
After fighting their way to Ploesch, Sternfels and his 98th Bomb Group found the target obscured with thick plumes of black smoke.
One of the groups of the previous airplanes made another turn, and they saw a large refinery, and they bombed it. And that happened to be the target that we were assigned to bomb. And that cost our group a tremendous amount.
Of course, the smoke starts billowing up, flames flying 200, 300 feet into the air. There were planes coming toward them. They were going to cross. So planes were falling out of the sky right and left. It was a scene of real catastrophe.
This amazing picture, taken by fellow Airman Leroy Morgan, shows Sternfels' aircraft narrowly avoiding the smokestacks at Ploesch.
I saw the smokestacks on my right, and so I decided not to hit those, and so I banked the airplane a little bit and avoided them. I missed them by 65 feet.
Sternfels managed to drop his bombs where he could and then tried to maneuver his wounded aircraft home. He'd only make it as far as the island of Cyprus, where he'd have to make an emergency landing. Meanwhile, Butler and his 44th Bomb Group were the only unit to hit the target to which they were assigned.
We made it all the way back to Benghazi. Got out of the airplane, and there was an ambulance there, and a man grabbed me, and they hauled me off to the hospital to give a transfusion to somebody.
Coming up, the story of one crew that became famous merely for surviving, and a romance that caught the imagination of the American people when War Stories continues.
The numbers for the Ploesch raid were devastating. Over 50 B-24s shot down and 500 airmen dead or missing in action.
When the planes limped back, 30% of the planes were lost. It was disastrous. And instead of 75% of Ploesti's oil capacity being destroyed, maybe 40% had been destroyed in that raid.
For the boys from Libya, the mission had been tragic. And back in England, it wasn't much better. To shore up the sinking morale of the boys, a limit was set on the number of missions that could be flown by any airman.
Let me ask you about the missions. Who picked that number?
I think that was the 8th Air Force flying out of England. I think most pilots that flew at the 8th Air Force were required to fly 25 missions.
Since our losses were so high, General Eger put out an order that if anybody figures just 25 missions, then go home.
Bob Morgan and his crew would soon be household names. But back in October 42, before they'd flown any missions, tradition had required that they name their B-17. Pilot Bob Morgan got some resistance at first for the name that he wanted.
I'm dating this girl, and she's from Memphis. What about the name Memphis Belle? No. They didn't think that was such a good idea.
His power of persuasion, and more than a couple of beers, won over his crew.
I didn't really count how many we had, but we had quite a few.
Their B-17 was christened the Memphis Belle, and the nose of the plane was painted with a sketch of Morgan's Memphis sweetheart, Margaret Polk.
A new form of art emerged, and this was what was called nose art. And there was a style that was developed, a kind of Vargas Girl, Esquire magazine kind of pinup. That was done.
The main artist at that time was named Petty, and I called him on the phone, told him I wanted a picture, wanted one of his paintings, just said he'd be glad to send one. He did. That's how I got the Memphis Belle.
The nose art was a fun distraction, but once the crew of the Memphis Belle hit the skies, they were all business. The Belle flew missions against submarine pens, railway yards, and naval bases in Germany, all among the most dangerous targets the 8th Air Force attempted. To keep the crew psyched up, Morgan gave them a pep talk before each raid.
We had a little thing, and when we got out there getting ready to go on a mission, just before we climbed in the airplane, we said, "Guys, if only one airplane comes back today, it's going to be a... Think positive. Don't think, oh, gee whiz, this may be my last mission."
By mission 15, they defied the odds and survived the halfway mark for going home. One day, Morgan was surprised by a visit from Oscar-winning producer William Wyler.
Since we were one of the few crews that were still there and had a lot of combat experience, he came to us and he said, "I've been instructed to get some combat film." And he said, "I wondered, Morgan, if I could fly a few missions with you.
This crew was singled out because it was close to being done, and it was chosen for a wartime morale-boosting film about life of the 8th Air Force.
I said, Bill, I'll tell you what, we'll try it, but if it doesn't work, I'll have to say we have to stop. So we tried it on a mission. He was just great. I mean, he was running all over that airplane with a camera in one hand and oxygen bottle in the other hand. So he ended up flying 5 combat missions with us.
As the crew neared the magic number of 25 missions, Morgan tried to keep them focused on the raids ahead.
In those last missions, the air crew began to get really nervous. Because then they could see the end, and you don't want to go down on that last one or two or three or four or fifth mission.
He just didn't try to dwell on that particular subject.
Despite some very close calls, the crew of the Bell were the first in the 8th Air Force to complete their 25 missions.
After we landed at that 25th mission, William Wyler said to me, you know, this filming we've been making, it's going to be a documentary, and we're going to call it the Memphis Bell. It was news, but that wasn't the most important news to me or any other crew member. The important news was we were going home.
They were happy just to be alive, but what happened next was beyond anyone's expectations.
That's when the publicity started.
Bag and baggage and hasty goodbyes and the prospect of home sweet home.
We had to go down to London and be interviewed.
They even had an audience with the Queen of England. Bob Morgan and his boys were asked to do one last good deed for their country.
So they decided to send the bomber and the crew home and do what they called the 26th mission.
Their 26th mission would be a war bond tour of America covering 20 states. It was a time when America had to raise money to fight, and the crew of the Memphis Bell flew their bomber from town to town. First stop, Washington, D.C., then to Memphis, and a chance to reunite with his girlfriend, Margaret Polk, the Memphis Bell. Unbeknownst to the boys, they were already celebrities.
Air Corps had built this up so much in the newspapers, you know, this love story of the Memphis Bell, Margaret Polk, and Bob Morgan. So, you know, it was very interesting, and we wanted to get married.
Morgan's plan was to marry Margaret Polk while he was in Memphis, but the Air Force had other plans.
We had a public relations captain that was flying with us. He talked to the people of Washington, and he said, they would wish you all would put off your wedding until after this tour is over, because the publicity is so great just as it is, a love story. So after much discussion, we decided to put it off.
Morgan went on the Goodwill tour and Margaret stayed behind. And this would be their undoing. After a party in New York where the Daily News ran a picture showing Morgan on the arm of another girl, the engagement was called off. The famous love story was now history.
So that's how we broke up. We stayed friends. We always did. She died in 1990. Matter of fact, my late wife and I visited her many times before she died in Memphis.
War on the men that flew the unfriendly skies over Europe when War Stories continues. I think the Memphis Bell was a morale booster, but it didn't do anything really to hide from these men. Their chances of survival were not good.
While the crew of the Bell was on tour, the bomber boys were facing seemingly insurmountable problems. There were shortages of just about everything.
It took a long time to train crews. Planes were being produced, but the 8th Air Force was running out of aircraft, running out of air crews.
I was among the crews that were accelerated in training to replace those crews that went down.
By late 1943, Germany was anything but a conquered enemy. The lumbering Allied bombers' assignments were the same hard targets that continue to fuel Hitler's war machines. The cities, Wilhelmshaven, Schweinfurt, Regensburg, and Munich, to name a few. But with the raids came scores of casualties. One mission to Schweinfurt on October 14th was so bloody, it was dubbed Black Thursday. 60 B-17s were lost, many more damaged, and 594 men were listed as missing in action. Pilot David Hutchins remembers the mission as if it were yesterday.
The German fighters really worked us over. It was like a parachute drop with all the airplanes going down. So we dropped our bombs and turned for home. It had an engine problem. We couldn't keep up with the formation.
Bill Eagleson, then a second Lieutenant Bombardier, remembers the dreaded fighters.
You could see other planes go down. You could see the German fighters coming in, slow rolling, taking one of your buddies with them.
You begin to wonder, you know, how are you going to get 25 missions in with these statistics working? So that works on you psychologically. You know.
By January 1944, the Allies had wrenched southern Italy from the grip of Field Marshal Kessel. The 15th Air Force moved to air bases in Foggia and Cerignola. And with the new bases came a new fighter aircraft, the P-51 Mustang, with its long-range fuel tanks.
When they introduced the P-51s with the wing tanks, they brought us right into the target area. It gave us a great feeling of having someone helping to protect us.
And that was our savior. That went all the way to the target with us and brought us home.
The fighter escort gave the boys new confidence, but death or capture was still a constant reality. Fresh from the raid on Tokyo, newly appointed 8th Air Force Commander, Lieutenant General Jimmy Doolittle, came up with a new strategy. B-24 Navigator Abe Weiland, son of Jewish immigrants, remembers the briefing.
He said to us, "You men are expendable. Your object is to knock out the Luftwaffe. When we invade the continent, we don't want any German or enemy planes in the air."
So the bombers were basically bait at that phase of the war.
They routed us around through fighter areas where we would bring up fighter planes.
While dogfights raged around them, the boys inside the bombers had to endure the harsh conditions inside their planes.
What was that airplane was like?
Those planes were not heated. The temperature inside would be around 45 or 50 degrees below zero. We were on oxygen from 10,000 feet on up. So you had these sheep-lined helmets with goggles and then the oxygen mask right up under the goggles and then solid sheepskin-lined shoes and flak vests and all the rest.
The Luftwaffe fighters weren't the only problem for the bomber boys. Adding to the danger were thousands of fragments of anti-aircraft fire called flak.
Little pellets keep flying all around, little pieces of the shell. And you're looking and you see black puffs here, black puffs all over the place.
Flak started usually at the coast, and it was the vicious kind. It was called tracking flak, and usually manned by German troops, and it would just puff up to your aircraft. When we got into the target, we had barrage flak, and that was 4th of July all over again. That just came in all directions.
Weiland remembers what it was like to see the aircraft next to him go down in flames.
Well, we watched, look for the parachute, see how many men were able to come out. Sometimes we saw the plane just blow up, nobody comes out. Once in a while, you know, by a quirk of fate, as they blow up the plane, some of these guys have their chutes already on. They're out, and they pull the cord and open the chute.
But fate had other plans for him. On a May 8, 1944 mission to Brunswick, Germany, the moment all airmen fear came true for Weiland.
We were rammed by a German fighter that we went down. But we had already gotten in orders from the pilot to bail out. And then we started to come out one by one. I started to come down. And I'm looking around, there's a lot of men running around. They look like farmers, and they're waiting for me to come down. And when they did, they came over to me, and the first guy pointed the gun to my head and asked for my fur-lined boots. And then they started to march me back into town. I want to know what they're going to do with me. Do they treat me as an American officer, or do they treat me as a Jew? That was running through my mind.
His plane was shot up and he was forced to bail out into the heart of Nazi Germany. And he just happens to be Jewish. How does Navigator Abe Weiland survive? That's next on War Stories.
After bailing out over Germany, Abe Weiland was in a bit of trouble. At gunpoint, his boots were taken, and he was marched to the town of Celle.
The mayor takes a few of his city officials, and they crowd around me, and they're marching me through the middle of town. And I'm looking at the people in the town lined up on both sides of the road with clubs and pitchforks, and everybody's hollering, "Juden, Juden." The fact that I was Jewish made me more of an enemy than anybody else.
During his interrogation, it seemed his German captors knew everything about him.
And a German officer sits opposite me, and he had the big book right in front of us. He opens the book, and I take a look, and there's my crew pictured on that page, where we were educated, where we were trained.
After hours of questioning, Weiland was thrown into a filthy boxcar. He had no idea where he was going.
They had anywhere from 60 to 80 men in a boxcar. The only air coming into the boxcar were little cracks in the side of them. Men with dysentery, nausea, and the stench was horrendous in there.
When the train stopped, he was a prisoner of war camp Stalag Luft 3. Conditions at the camp weren't much better than on the boxcar, especially the food.
We didn't get that much to eat. It was a pretty sad situation as far as food was concerned. The Red Cross gave us packages, but the Germans were stealing the Red Cross packages so they could eat.
Summer 1944, while Abe Weiland was a POW, George McGovern and his crew were flying missions all over Germany and Austria.
The worst mission?
The worst mission was probably over the Skoda ammunition works in Pilsen, Czechoslovakia. We lost an engine on the way into the target. I advanced the other three engines and stayed in formation until we got to the target, and we got hit hard over the target. We lost another engine.
All of a sudden, all of the oil came out over our rudder. And when that happened, it froze.
We started back to the home base in Italy, and we got about to the head of the Adriatic Sea. We were over Yugoslavia, and we lost the third engine, and we were losing altitude then pretty rapidly.
So McGovern said, let's start throwing things out of here. And we threw everything that we could get our hands on out of the airplane. Fortunately, the Viz, a little island off of the coast of Yugoslavia, was there as an emergency strip. A very small landing area, very short, in between mountains.
As I lined up with the runway, I could see the carcasses of bombers that had smashed into a hill at the end of the runway.
McGovern needed 4,000 feet of runway to safely land his B-24, the Dakota Queen. He had half of what he needed.
Luck was with us, and we put that plane down right on the end of the runway, and the co-pilot and I both got on the brakes as hard as we could press. We were right up out of our seats, jamming those brakes all the way down. That plane ground to a halt just a few feet from the end of the runway.
When something like that happens, what's the reaction of the crew afterwards talking to their command pilot?
It was the only time I saw that crew leap out of the plane and down on the ground, kissing the ground. I hate to get into all that, Colonel, but it was a love feast when we walked away from it. They knew it was a good landing, and I did too.
He and his crew had three brushes with death and survived them all. But Higgins doesn't chalk it up to luck.
He was a good pilot. I always said he brought us back, and conscientious pilot, sincere man. George got the, for that landing, got the Distinguished Flying Cross.
The relentless pounding of industrial targets finally paid off. In late 1944, Germany was no longer rebuilding destroyed factories or refineries.
Finally, one was able to see a sudden drop in German production across the board, but particularly in oil. So one of the reasons that bomber crews were not seeing as many Luftwaffe planes in the skies over Germany, but was they didn't have enough fuel.
Germany was collapsing in a cataclysm of destruction.
The Allies were closing in. The Nazis were virtually helpless to stop their advance. On April 29th, 1945, old blood and guts General George Patton's 3rd Army arrived at Stalag 7A. Abe Weiland was there and remembers his liberation as a joyous occasion.
Tanks came through, knocked the gate over, and somebody said, "Look, look." We took a look at the German barracks, command post, and somebody had climbed the flagpole, pulled down the Nazi flag, and put up Old Glory. And there were 130,000 prisoners of war in that camp who were just cheering away to beat the band.
The bomber boys, now men, were on their way home.
What was it like coming home?
I landed outside of Boston. We hit that field with a bang. And I got on the intercom. I said to the crew, well, I guess there's no doubt we have now hit the United States. Everybody laughed. They didn't care about it dropping in from 20 feet.
Boy, when I came into New York Harbor, I got the feeling. You know, I just couldn't talk. I was just spellbound. And I'm looking at the Statue of Liberty, and I'm free, and I'm home, and I'm an American, and I'm proud, and I'm happy. God bless America.
I'm Oliver North. Stay right here on Fox News for more war stories. Over 40,000 airmen lost their lives flying impossible missions in an effort to deny Hitler the black gold and other materials he needed to wage war. For many survivors of those missions, the trip back home brought a struggle to figure out why they lived and their fellow airmen had not. Though that question goes unanswered to this day, one thing they knew for sure, their efforts changed the face of war forever. Douglas Haig Griffiths, one of their own number, wrote, "They carved new legends in the skies and redefined how wars are fought. They laid foundations for all time. It was done by men of a special kind." They were indeed men of a special kind. And theirs is a war story that deserves to be told. Good night.